You gotta see the money coming in. It's through the roof, man.
This isn't playtime. This is serious business.
Well, the play must go on, I believe.
I'm always home. I'm on tour.
I've been thinking a lot about dying lately.
I'm trying to do good. That's that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of That's That, a Philip Seymour Hoffman retrospective podcast. My name is Timothy Mark Davis, and I'm your host. Today, we are talking about Leap of Faith, the 1992 comedy/drama/romance directed by Richard Pierce and starring Steve Martin, Deborah Winger, Liam Neeson, Lolita Davidovich, Lucas Haas, Meatloaf, and an early career Philip Seymour Hoffman. I hope you took some time to watch the film on Amazon Prime. You could have done the CBS All Access 7-day free trial. You could have rented it for a few bucks, whatever that may be. But the film does, I think, show a fierce commitment of a young actor before anyone knew who he was, before his name was recognized, before the camera was even pointed at him. And he forced it to be as such, which we'll get into a little bit later. But my guests today are friends and aspiring faith healers, Joel D'Souza and Matt Wright. Joel, Matt, how are you guys today?
Doing great, Tim. First. Thanks for having us on, bud.
Joel.
Joel, how are you doing?
Too polite.
Matt just steamrolled you.
Too polite.
Too polite, I know. Awkward.
It's the usual.
Can we try that first question again?
Joel's doing just fine. I'll answer for him.
No, I'm doing great.
So today we're talking about Leap of Faith, which features Philip Seymour Hoffman as Matt, not to be confused with Matt Wright, the aspiring faith healer on the podcast today. Matt is the enthusiastic roadie, stagehand, groupie, revival plant who helps our lead characters swoop into these towns and milk them for all their cash. Here is the logline from IMDb. Fake faith healer Jonas Nightingale is stranded in a small town where he finds he can't fool all of the people all of the time. Here's the logline from Amazon Prime. A holy roller con man and his caravan, stranded in a small Kansas town, decide to put on their show. But romance and a suspicious local sheriff upset the plan! Exclamation point. With Liam Neeson, Philip Seymour Hoffman. That's literally what it says. It just says, with Liam Neeson, comma, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Doesn't say Steve Martin. Doesn't say any of the other characters who are way more important. So my first question for you guys, which one of these log lines makes you want to watch the movie more?
I would be a little disappointed on that second one to turn it on and realize that Liam Neeson wasn't the preacher of this big tit revival.
yes, true. Yeah, it does
or
seem that
he
that
wasn't
way.
Beating somebody up. I mean,
yeah,
this is
off brand.
He was way too kind.
This is off brand. This is back when he was.
But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
As mentioned, Leap of Faith was directed by Richard Pierce, whose other directing credits include Heartland, Threshold, Country, No Mercy, The Long Walk Home, and A Family Thing, of which I have seen none. Matt, you're old. Have you seen any of these movies?
I haven't even heard of any of those.
Me neither.
So, to this guy's credit, I'm going to start a podcast about his movies. If you guys want to jump on that wagon before anybody else.
I would do that. You know what I thought was interesting? He was the cinematographer for the 2008 documentary Food, Inc., which I know was a film that helped all of us realize the trash we've been putting into our bodies.
Wow.
Have we changed? No.
No.
And at least we know.
That was cutting edge film back in the day. Now it's kind of like one of a dozen, but.
I know. What's the food doc this month that's going to tell me how fat I am?
I don't know what you guys are talking about. I protested that movie.
It's all of your investments in the chicken wing industry and the pork industry.
I'm
not going to have it.
It's my early childhood being raised inside a Burger King.
That's true.
So the real question is...
You can't take that from me.
What's the real question, Joel?
Which one's his greater name to fame? Is it like Food, Inc. or is it Leap of Faith?
It's Leap of Faith because he directed it. Food, Inc., who would even know that he No one cares about the DP unless you're a film nerd, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Leap of Faith is his most well-known. It's biggest box office success, blah, 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 blah.
And yet it didn't project him onto greater and bigger things, huh?
It didn't really. It didn't. Yeah. And that's probably because the movie isn't very good, but I'm not, I don't want to get there too soon.
Well, there we are.
The film has a 64% on Rotten Tomatoes, if that means something to you. I couldn't find the budget estimates, but I can only imagine you'd need several Leap of Faiths to equal the budget size of the most overrated movie ever made, Titanic. The film was shot between June 21st and September 1st, 1992 in Claude, Groom, Happy, Irving, Plainview, and Tulia, Texas. Yes, those were all the names of cities. It was released on December 15th, 1992, which is another incredibly fast turnaround from production to release. We said the same thing, I think, on last episode, Ides of March, which you'll have heard by now. Very quick production turnaround. A few other notable facts and pieces of trivia that I will dump on you all and the audience, regardless of whether you care to hear them or not. Steve Martin, actually, Matt, you might care about this. Steve Martin took over the lead role after Michael Keaton quit the production.
Huh. That would have been a completely different movie.
Very different movie. Very different movie. And this is like Steve Martin in his prime, kind of, too, right?
So this was 92. So that would have been like just after Batman.
Yeah. Well, I was reading Michael up on Keaton today a little bit, and it was like, you know, he was doing all the comedies, the Beetlejuice, and then he was like, forget this, I want to be a dramatic actor. And
yeah,
he's had a multiple career reinventions, it would seem. The movie was adapted into a Broadway musical in 2012, featuring music by Alan Menken of Little Mermaid fame. It ran only 19 performances.
Oh my gosh.
So it was a major flop, but it starred.
Surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. Although you'd think with like the gospel
music
in this movie is amazing, but couldn't
make
it
a little
work.
Meatloaf. They should have Meatloaf. They should have Meatloaf do the music.
Oh my gosh. Could you imagine? But the musical starred Raul Esparza, very, very famous Broadway actor, Jessica Phillips, and a little known talent named Leslie Odom Jr. pre Hamilton. Little fun fact for you.
There you go.
This was the most interesting thing that I found in the trivia. 2.5 years after the release of the movie, the United States witnessed its most influential Christian revival event that lasted 5 years in Pensacola, Florida, from 1995 to 2000. It was dubbed the Brownsville Revival. 1 week, Tuesday through Saturday event, it brought in over 2.5 million people. And at the end of this movie, if you remember when Jonas hitches a ride in the truck, he tells him he's going to Pensacola.
That's right. Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
Like, how weird is that? That's kind of weird.
That's funny.
But the reason we're here, this is Philip Seymour Hoffman's fourth feature film, where again, he plays groupie, con man, stagehand, and revival enthusiast, Matt.
Great
Joel,
name.
Matt, great name, great solid name. What are your overall thoughts, feelings, and impressions of the film Leap of Faith?
I mean, it just feels to me, you know, in the last several months, I've watched a fair share of rom-coms, and I'm just like, this is so classic 90s. It's it is. And part of me, I mean, actually a larger part of me, doesn't like that. I don't like the 90s. Not these sorts of films.
Oh, Matt.
Please dig in, Joel.
Oh,
please dig in.
Yeah. Yes. Matt, do you have something
this
to say?
I'm here.
No, I'll let you finish. Then we'll mute you.
Oh, jeez.
I'm just kidding.
No, I mean, yeah, it has all those features to it, and I think they're fun. I mean, if you're looking for a fun, lighthearted time in the living room, it's definitely kid-friendly.
So the drama didn't get to you? It was a comedy for you?
No. Yes, it was a comedy. Well, among other reasons, it wasn't just the acting, but the whole spiritual and, I mean, everything. It was just comedic.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, this
it's
was
comedic until you realize that that is a real thing that works and preachers have been doing it for decades, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get right to that, but
yeah, we will get to that. We will get to that. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. Matt, your overall thoughts, feelings, and impressions of the film.
No, I mean, I would say, like, I'm a huge Steve Martin fan in general. Like, I love the guy. I love what he's doing now with the music.
Oh, yeah.
I've read his biography. I think everything, I think he's a genius, but look, this is definitely not one of those top 10 films. And but the funny thing was, I was trying to think back. I was like, when did I see this? I think my dad took me to see this in the theater.
Wow.
So I was trying to think back. And
sorry, Matt, I wasn't trying to ruin any of your childhood memories.
No, it's cool. It was the last movie my dad and I saw together.
Oh, thanks, Joel. Before that Burger King went up in flames.
Exactly.
While he was still
it was
in there.
Terrible.
But he was trying to grab your bed and your sheets so you'd have something to sleep on that night. But alas,
it just didn't work.
Couldn't make it.
No, but that's
that
fine,
fry
Joel,
oil, it'll get you.
I'm glad you didn't like it.
Love you, Mark Wright.
No, I think, I mean, it was a fun film. I enjoyed it. I had to break it up into two sessions just because I was losing interest, but it was, it drug a little there in the middle. And
it's got a saggy middle.
Pretty predictable, but I think it was a fun ride there for a bit.
I think it has its scenes. It has its moments. Honestly, the first, like, the montage of them setting up the tent with the gospel choir singing and all of the people going out asking people to come to the revival, to me, I think that is the best scene in the whole movie. It is so cool. And the gospel choir is so good.
Yeah.
And just watching that tent go up, Joel, I actually wanted to ask you just like the technical achievement of that tent with the trusses and the lights and the, you know, they obviously skipped a couple steps in what we were watching.
Yeah.
But I was just astounded by, oh yeah, they just put all this in a bunch of semis, and then where are they getting power from? Or is it just like totally fictional? Help me try to understand technically what is going on. Cause I think that was
generators, right?
The best scene. Oh, I guess that makes, is that enough power though? For that,
there's huge generators. They're likely semis. From the way it looked. I mean, this is probably generators. Usually, people aren't setting up those size tents out in the middle of a cornfield. they're usually setting them up somewhere closer to actual like power and infrastructure.
Well, apparently, but you've never been to a revival.
Yeah, I'm not used to revivals. Again, Matt, I was just 2 years old, you know, when the 90s were happening. I apologize.
Oh, I'm pretty sure we could find you one today.
Yeah.
A big tent revival?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Georgia, somewhere.
Somewhere. If you're a part of a big tent revival and you're listening to this, please DM me.
No, I had friends that were in the tent industry who built tents during summers, and it's a huge undertaking. So that and a tent that size, I mean, those were all the rage back then too. I mean, that thing was beautiful. Once it was up, you're like, wow.
It was.
I want to go in there.
It was astounding.
Yeah, it was pretty much like a circus. Cool.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they have like air. I assume there's like some sort of air conditioning going on in there.
Then.
It's, no, not back then.
Not way back, not in back the then, 90s, Tim.
Well, that sounds horrible.
Now.
Why would anyone go?
Because they need a little hope. Didn't you watch the movie? Gosh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So
no
I guess,
rain.
So I guess I really loved that scene, and I really loved the choir. And some of Steve Martin's sermons I found funny and just kind of silly and enjoyable.
He had those one-liners down, didn't he?
Yes, the 12-gauge shotgun of love.
Oh,
that was
gosh.
Like, or 12-gauge grenade launcher of love. I'm like, I got to use that. We got to bring that phrase into the common. I'm going to blow you up with my 12-gauge grenade launcher of love.
that needs to be the subtitle of this episode.
Probably.
Yes, that should be in somebody's campaign these days. I mean.
Yes. Build back better. Keep America great. Get out of here.
Right.
Garbage slogans. So yeah, it was like a couple moments, a couple of the scenes. I think the thing for me that made it really difficult to get into is that the relationships were just so unbelievable. Like the romance that's trying to happen with Marva, the waitress at the diner, with Steve Martin, that just never really clicked for me. Her contempt for him from the beginning didn't quite make sense. It felt a little manufactured just to put some conflict in the story.
Yeah.
The whole Sheriff Will and Jane, like,
romance. Getting married in like, 4 days.
Yeah, ready to propose. Right.
Oh, it was just... And that's sort of like the emotional center of the movie, but it none of that landed for me, honestly.
No, I agree. Like, when that scene popped up with Jane and the sheriff at his house, and he was holding her feet at that point, I was like,
"Yes,
what?
the feet."
I was
that
like,
was jarring.
This
yeah,
is so awkward. I was like, "This is not right. Well, how did we get here?"
Well, he does. I mean, he does have a very special set of skills. So,
Oh my God. It would have been easier to watch a sex scene than to watch him play with her feet. It was weird. It was like, this is.
That's true, actually. It would have made more sense.
Yeah.
There's like, it's a like, okay, too much intimacy together. In foot massages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
that's
people
not
boink
day four.
All the time, you know?
You
people
up
boink
90?
On day one all the time, but you do not give a foot massage in the first weekend.
Absolutely.
I don't think I've heard the term boink since 1992. So
well, I'm trying to be relevant for
I know that
you, know,
that you did your
Gen
research.
X listeners.
I appreciate that. I respect it.
Thank you.
No,
yeah, so let's go ahead, Joel.
Oh, I was just going to say, I know I agree with the Marva critique just coming off so strong at the beginning. It was like, what? But I guess there's a little bit of context once she starts. I mean, if she picked up on the fact that this guy had come to town, they're all, you know, their bus is so huge and obvious about what they do. If she did have that past experience with a fake evangelist, like that might be a little bit more believable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I think something about it just didn't, something about the acting or the performance of for her role, it just didn't land. Or even like Steve Martin, like he wants her, but he's also kind of wants Jane.
That was confusing to me too.
I don't know. I couldn't track the relationships. You know what's funny too is I was looking at the IMDb user reviews. People love this movie. There are so many like 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 reviews. People saying it's like, oh, this is one of my top 5 favorite films ever. And this is Steve Martin's best performance. And I think Steve Martin's fine in it. You know, I just...
It's no Three Amigos.
No, it's no Three Amigos. But I just don't buy... I don't think I buy the character arc. I'm also not sure that I even know what the character arc is for him. Like... The ending, which we'll get into a little bit later, the ending was a little bit confusing for me. I'm interested to see what you guys think about that. But I do want to jump into the Philip Seymour Hoffman performance. So let's listen to what is the bulk of it right now.
You give that kid a haircut, man. You put him in some fancy clothes. You put that kid on the stage. It's money in the bank, man.
Hey, well, maybe we could even get him to reenact it.
Do you know what we could bring in Dallas in 1 week? 1 week. Seven figures, man. Jonas, man. What do you think?
Come on, Jonas.
Do it.
Do it! You're a genius, man! Genius!
So...
Seven figures, man.
You're a genius, man. Oh, yeah. So I think I'm going to jump right into every time I do these episodes, I'm always looking at, you know, what did the cast members or the director, are there any interviews of people talking about working with Phil, what it was like, what he was like? And I came across this really short Meatloaf interview. Meatloaf is the bus driver. He's one of the other groupies who help enact these cons as they go from city to city. And this is what Meatloaf had to say about working with Philip Seymour Hoffman on this film. He was very creative in the fact that he always wanted to try and get a camera to come over to him. And sometimes they would tell him, Philip, sit down, don't do that anymore. The director loved him. And I remember the director saying to me, this kid's really good. And I'm going, well, I could do that stuff too, but I've been trying to stay out of the way of Liam Neeson, Deborah Winger, and Steve Martin. But Philip was young and impetuous, and he went for it. And I feel like that quote for me sums up the entire performance. What did you guys think of Phil's performance in this?
Matt, you first.
That is the performance in a nutshell. I mean, you can just tell he's just happy to be there, right? I mean, every scene.
I'm in a Steve Martin movie.
Yeah, I think that was him. I don't think he was acting. I mean, I think he is that character at that age. You know, like, I mean, he was just so excited to be there, so excited to be in a film, so excited to be see the camera coming his way. You know, it's just like, you know, just always big smile. And I know that was the character, but it was hilarious to watch. And I remember sitting there saying, like, man, if he doesn't speak soon, we're not going to have much to talk about on this podcast.
He's got like one little scene. Little monologue. He's got a couple lines, but it's mostly just that little monologue there. Yeah. But the camera does find him multiple times, like especially during the revival. Like there's several shots of like getting his reactions. He does this little move one time. Like there was, he was clearly on set being like, please point the camera at me. I'm doing something interesting, I swear.
Yeah. And
they cut him in.
Yeah, I think so. I kept looking at it going like, he's the producer of this big old Salvation show. You know, I mean, he is the guy who, he was the keeper.
He runs the plays.
Yeah, he does. Like he was the keeper of the sign of the cross, right? Like he handed it to Steve Martin's character to put on people's foreheads and. You know, he was just like the guy that was making it all happen behind the scenes.
Well, and at things like that, you need that sort of energy. Like that is, there's so much difference between when they're behind stage, off the stage, and when they're in front and on stage. And he was willing to show up, you know, and, you know, knowing how acting can be, like it can be intimidating. It can be this, like, do I want to be that extra? And not only was that helpful for his career, but it was helpful for this specific movie. And that sort of energy, that sort of crazy and pizzazz lent itself in this context, I think. And so I think he was really playing into the part. I think he was having fun too, you know, like he found what was nuts about this context, and he was like, oh, let's just do that up. And some people weren't as willing to like jump off the deep end in that scene or in that way.
I think that's spot on, and something that I'm always so impressed by in a Philip Seymour Hoffman performance, regardless of the size, is his ability to find the thing that is really interesting and like no one else would do it that way. And it makes you look again, it makes you look closer, but it still fits into the movie. It still fits the character. It still fits the story. And that's like way harder to do than you would think, because any actor can, I mean, like you said, Joel, do that sort of extra, let me just like pour some sauce on this. Let me bring the heat, bring the fire, do something lively and zany and try to basically gain attention for myself. Well, which, you know, based on Meatloaf's quote, it sounds like he was trying to do that in a way. Right. But like you said, it fits. I mean, that's the people you need. That's the people you need to pull off a big tent revival. You know, this blind enthusiasm that for Phil's character is rooted in seven figures, man. right. But at least to the outside, it looks like, you know, 12-gauge shotgun grenade launcher of love for God, basically.
Yeah. I think he's just so excited about the potential, you know, like he's having fun with it. He understands that it's a show and that it's part of his job to make this show work and to make it as successful as possible. And if they can get, you know, one thing to happen to where they can get on the big time, then it's going to be just payday. And so he's playing that way. I mean, I really think that his character in this movie could have not even said one word. But just by his reactions and the way he kind of owned the camera when it was on him, he would still be a recognizable part and a main part of the movie.
Well, like you said, like the his main lines came so far at the end. It was like I was waiting 2, I was like, where is this guy? But even when they, like you said, the camera did find him in several scenes. And I remember the one that sticks out to me is like Steve Martin needs something. And he looks over and like Philip's ready. He's like, and the camera finds him and you can see the intensity in his face. He's like, do you want me to do it? And he gets the nod and then he's like, all right, I'll go do it. You know? And he's like, boom. And it's just so like that sort of energy carries. And when it's not there, it's like, oh, okay, well the idea gets across that it's like, okay, this guy's going to go do something. But like, I felt his energy like inside of me. And it's like, oh wow, that made it through the camera and out of my computer and into me. And it was like, oh
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because you know, this being his fourth feature film he's ever done, you know, this came out before Scent of a Woman, which was considered his break, or at least one of his breaks. I think he actually has a few breaks in his career that vault him to more recognizable status, but Scent of a Woman is certainly what made the industry turn and say, hey, this is a guy we need to start putting in supporting actor roles. This is before that. So he's got that same energy that you're talking about for his career. And somehow he's able to like bring that, you know, this is what's happening in my life. I'm trying to, not to get too weird and metaphorical, but I'm trying to attach myself to the entertainment industry. I'm trying to become a part of telling stories where I can make this a living and be an actor full time and work on stage and on screen. And at this point in his career, it was not guaranteed. It was not together. It was very much in flux and a risk. And so he's bringing all of that energy from his own life into this performance, but in a way that makes sense and is believable. And there's this clip that I want to play really quick that I think captures a little bit of what he was doing in this film, but then throughout his career as well.
This is what Bennett Miller says about you. He works himself into a state of crisis and distress, worrying that people are going to know he's a fraud and that his career is over.
He talks too much. Okay. Well, you do think your career is going to be over all the time. I mean, that's pretty common. I mean, actors kind of feel that way all the time. I mean, yeah. And there's a level of embarrassment, meaning you're exposed. Part of my job is actually that it's me. I'm not a painter, I'm not a musician, I'm not these things where actually I'm creating something that then I can distance myself and you can actually experience it. I'm actually the one. It's me, my body, my head, my mind, my voice. It's right here, you know? And there is something about people criticizing that or failing in that realm, and it's actually you they're talking about. That is, that's hard. That's hard to take, and I do fear that, definitely.
Is that the steam that drives the engine? I mean, is that part of the whole thing that makes you good?
Sometimes I'll set things up for myself that I don't know if I'll be able to achieve. Meaning I'll create, like Bennett's saying, I'll create a crisis, ultimately, with a part I'll take or with a job I'll take. And that's really just, a lot of other people say it's a risk. They'll say, I took the risk. It's a risky part or whatever. People say you're courageous or whatever. I think that's a bunch of baloney. It's just a risk. It's going to be a risk, you know? That is creating a crisis, because all of a sudden you're in a crisis moment because you have to actually come through with it. And there's going to be a lot that you're going to have to do to come through with it. And then you're actually going to have the will to actually do it. And you're going to have the will to actually fail and look like an ass and probably be bad and all these things in front of people. You're going to have to actually do that in order to be good. You know, you actually have to go in and start failing and start risking and start humiliating yourself sometimes right there in front of people in order to get to the good stuff.
So you walk yourself out on a narrow ledge and then talk your way back
sometimes
in.
Sometimes. Not all roles do I need to do that, but sometimes I do.
So good.
I think one of the roots of this podcast for me is just getting to go through all of these interview clips and listen to Phil talk about acting. I have watched so many in the last 10 years. I've watched so many interviews of Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it's finally becoming useful information because I can reach back for it. But you know, trying to connect these different things, you know, the point he was at in his career, the way Meatloaf talks about how he was on set. This idea, you know, this interview was done after Capote. Bennett Miller's director for Capote, also directed Moneyball, which is actually going to be our next episode. And so this interview was done 2006, 2005, right around when Capote came out. So years after Leap of Faith and much more established in his career. But I feel like this idea of creating a risk, of creating a situation where failure is probable or imminent or at least very possible, it seems like he brought that energy to this film. It was like, it's almost like the goal was, nobody knows me. I'm a no name. I'm trying to make it in this business. My goal is to get the camera on me as many times as possible, which coming into a set with, I mean, friggin' Steve Martin, who's just a legend, and at the time a legend, and at the height of his career, and having the courage to give so much to a performance, you know, this energy that we've been talking about. It's like, as a 25-year-old, you know, it's your fourth feature film, you're still so young. Where does that courage even come from? It's amazing to me.
I think it's so rare. I think that's why he stands out. You know, he says it's like, it's not courage, you know, it's just a risk. But like, no, it is courage. I would say he's wrong. Yeah. I would say he's completely wrong in that statement. Yeah. It takes so much courage. He goes on to describe like the risk taking and the failing and the vulnerability. It's like all that takes courage. It's like showing up like that, exposing yourself, exposing your body, exposing your approach. It's like, oh, I was thinking through the role this way, and or wow, that, you know, I'm positive in his roles he failed, he totally interpreted an idea wrong or a character wrong, but that discovery process is what he found valuable and where he found the gold. You know, it was like, okay, I got it wrong 10 times, but I found it on the 11th. And some people never find the 11th because they never did the 10. They only tried one or two different ways. They didn't risk far enough. And yet he always had the courage to try iterations and to fail and to get back up. And that's hard. I'd say that's hard if you're whatever you do, that's hard in life. So the fact that he chose to bring that into his acting career, anybody who does that in any arena, it shows. It stands out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he didn't let failure scare him, right? I mean, he was basically like, look, if I'm going to make this work, I need to separate myself from the competition, so to speak, right? Yeah. And so that was just kind of his style, it seems like, especially in these early films where he was just taking those risks, doing whatever he had to do, regardless of whether the director asked him to or not, you know? And sometimes it worked, you know, like the Meatloaf quote said, you know, or sometimes the director yelled at him, told him to stop. But
right. What's funny is that Meatloaf never tried. Meatloaf, who knows Meatloaf? Like, who's Meatloaf? Like, he's talking.
Hey, Meatloaf is one of the greatest artists of all time. Okay.
Meatloaf is very famous.
Musicians, sorry.
Yeah.
But not as an actor. I mean, he's critiquing Philip. Yeah. And it's like, no, Philip did what it took, you know, like, and Philip goes on to have a very successful career in acting. And it's like, he didn't have the courage to do that. He didn't. And that's just the two examples. It's great that we have a quote from him.
I don't think Meatloaf even cared about acting, to be honest. I feel like he was just doing it because he could and it was fun.
Yeah, I think he stumbled into it. They're like, we need a truck driver. And he was like, I'll do it.
Can I play one of my songs?
Exactly. We'll put one of my songs into the movie and that's it. You don't have to pay me.
Right. Also, your
name
is
Meatloaf. Has no grounding.
I'm sorry, that's ridiculous.
No, critique has no grounding at all. Unless he's like trying to play it into his like musical career.
Sure, sure.
But who knows? We'll have to get him on the podcast, find out.
Meatloaf, if you're listening to this, you've been named, sir. You've been called out. Come on the podcast and defend your honor.
The gauntlet has been dropped.
My name's Joel D'Souza. I dropped the gauntlet. You can come talk to me.
Well, can I bring up one thing that bothered me about the whole movie?
Yes.
why in the world did Steve Martin's character go for a jog in jeans, a button-up, and a cowboy hat? And then when he's questioned about that, he's like, well, I used to do it in my boots, too. And that's it. That's all that's said. That's all that's addressed. And like, and the kid, Brody's just like, oh, okay.
He was in a crop top, wasn't he?
You're right.
It was, like, cut off sleeves or something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It was so, yeah, that was the weirdest
outfit.
Oh, no,
that's what it was. There was a big belt buckle. There was a belt. He had a belt. So jeans, belt, cowboy hat.
Crop top showing his belly.
Crop top. Right.
The costume designer was just like, oh shit, I forgot about today's scene.
Here, wear this.
Wear Deborah's costume from last night. Or Steve Martin was like, it's just like a character choice. Like, you know, I've been thinking about this Jonas guy, and I really think he would jog in jeans.
You know, it'd be really funny.
Gosh.
If I wore jeans.
BS actor choices. It's like, it has meaning. No, it doesn't. You're just being weird.
Red meat, we crave sustenance.
I was thinking connected to Joel, what you were saying about how hard it is to do that. You know, I'm thinking about like being a total noob on a set in an industry, you know, when you're in the position of trying to prove yourself and trying to catch a break and trying to grow your career, again, whatever field you're in, like the courage it takes to give that much of yourself, to be that vulnerable, to lay it all on the line, is massive. And the interesting thing I was thinking, especially like if you become famous, I almost feel like it gets worse.
Yeah.
Because then the expectation for you to be so good, to arrive on set a certain way, to, you know, be in character or have all these great ideas, or, you know, oh, I bet Phil Hoffman just comes on set in like two takes and he's got it. Rather than this discovery process that you were talking about, I think ultimately what I'm really getting at is that, and we've already talked about this on this podcast, but it's a theme that keeps coming up because I think it's something that Phil really struggled with is how do you remain excellent at something? How do you remain at the top of your game when all of the other psychological factors are constantly surrounding what you're doing, whether it's nobody knows me, I'm trying to make a name for myself, or I'm famous and I have to turn in a great performance, or it's just like the pressures, especially as actors. And I think he puts it perfectly, you know, when your body, and I've talked about this before, when your body is the art, when your voice is the art, it's just like scary because a critique, it just is more personal than when you can stand apart from your art a little bit. Mm-hmm. So,
well, think about it. I mean, just going on that, on what you just said, I mean, it was probably just like a switch that flipped for him too. Like going from this no-name actor who's doing all he can to get the camera on him to all of a sudden people paying attention to him and having expectations of him. So, you know, you go from one side of the coin to the other pretty quickly. And so you're feeling pressures on both sides. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see it across the board from a lot of these. I mean, I would even say a lot of these actors that we know, or they have what that one style, whether it be like the comedy Adam Sandler movies, right? They're pretty much all the same movies, right? Because I think that was the expectation everyone had of him. And if you go see an Adam Sandler movie, you know, like Spanglish or one of those other movies where it's more serious, you
kind of Drunk Love, Uncut Gems,
right? A little bit different. You're like, whoa, this is not what we signed up for, you know, for the
most
part.
Those are my favorite Adam Sandler movies,
but I'm with you, I love them. But if you're going for Billy Madison 2, it is not. And I think, you know, he felt that pressure. Philip did, so you know, going from it, because I'm sure it happened pretty quickly. It was like, I'm this young, dumb kid trying to get on the camera to. Boom. Everyone knows me and has these expectations of me now when I walk on set.
You know, it's interesting though with his career, I almost feel like there were these jumps, you know, where it's like all of a sudden X percentage more people on earth know who I am.
Yeah.
But I've been reading, actually I just finished Matthew McConaughey's book, and Joel, I think you're reading it too, right? Or did you?
Yeah, I am.
Is that new one that just came out, the green?
Yeah, Green Lights.
Yeah.
So I just finished it last night, and he has this part where he talks about right before A Time to Kill came out, the week before it came out, he went to the Santa Monica Pier, and there were 400 people there, and you know, four people recognized him, and it was like, oh, it was three girls who thought he looked cute and one guy who was trying to sell him something. And nobody else knew who he was. A week later, A Time to Kill had come out that weekend. He went back a week later to the pier and he said 396 people knew who I was and four people didn't. And, you know, they were all babies. And so it's just like this instant, the switch was flipped and he became famous and everyone knew who he was and his career just skyrocketed, which to me, like, and he talks about this in the book, which was interesting, that the psychological pressure and insanity and imposter syndrome that caused. I think Phil definitely experienced that, but it seems like tracking his career, it happened a little more gradually and it never got to that level, like Matthew McConaughey level or Tom Cruise level, just insane movie stardom. And I think part of that is like his commitment to the theater, his commitment to, I'm a New York actor, I'm going to do plays, I'm going to be a part of it. You know, this, I'm going to be grounded in an artistic community with people who I know. And then, yes, I'm going to go out and do certain projects, go out and do certain films, a variety of characters, but be very selective in what I do and really do projects and characters that aren't going to bring me a ton of fame or recognition. You know, I think classically he doesn't look like the type of person who that's going to happen to anyways, but projects that are going to make him come alive. And he, you know, he has other interviews where he talks about trying, like he was afraid of fame. He was afraid of people knowing too much about his personal life. And he's pushing against that and kind of feels like, how can you be an actor if everyone knows all this stuff about you? Because the whole point is to make people believe you're someone else. If people know too much about you, it's going to disrupt that suspension of disbelief that's supposed to happen.
Expectations creep in.
Yeah.
Well, I think like he definitely had a certain, it seems as though he had like a certain goal in his purpose in acting that some people don't maybe have as much clarity on at the beginning. I saw recently, we're speaking of Matthew McConaughey a little bit, like a clip that he had talking with somebody on Instagram, and he talked about how like he became known for this very specific role and he eventually wanted to break that. And same thing, like part of it reminds me of Steve Martin too, like just this comedic role. And it's like, sometimes you can get automatically stuck in some of these. Adam Sandler and Philip probably worked pretty hard at not doing that.
Yeah.
And even, you know, speaking to this fame idea, it's like you played a clip where it's him speaking like 12, 14 years later. Mm-hmm. Something he might not have even known in 92 when he was playing this role, but he had something intuitively inside of him. He's now speaking about it 12, 14 years later, and it's still his mindset. It's still this way he is approaching his career and his mentality, and it's this risk. He never wants to get – he almost finds the discomfort exhilarating. It's like some people – will just want the safety of a paycheck, of a role they know they can play.
Yeah.
But he found a thrill in discovery and in being on the edge. It was like his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. To continue challenging himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, and you see that it's interesting to see it throughout his entire career. That sensibility, whereas McConaughey, and I love Matthew McConaughey. I think he's a great actor. I'm a fan. That's why I read his book.
Right.
But McConaughey, he talks about, you know, turning in all of these similar performances, like you were just describing, Joel, and just getting tired of it and needing a challenge, needing something to artistically stimulate him, and really going dry for about 20 months, just saying no to everything. Almost 2 years, he said no to everything until finally a project came along that started this reconnaissance where we get Mud and True Detective and Dallas Buyers Club and et cetera, et cetera. But Phil had that, you know, I think for sure in the beginning of his career, there's this sense of like, any role I can get, I will take, because mm-hmm. you just have to. In the beginning, you have to make money. You got to put food on the table. But you see this sharpening of his career choices. The older he gets, the more selective, and not just like, this is a project I want to do. But what you just said, Matt, you know, this is a project that is a risk. Like he's talking about in the clip, that's going to challenge me, that scares me a little bit. And that's the only reason I want to do it, because mm-hmm. it creates that discomfort. It creates that resistance that he can then push against and give him a challenge to make him feel artistically alive.
And I don't think all artists have that. I think that I would say, I just don't think everybody has that mentality. Like you just said, Matthew McConaughey got old or he got tired of the role he was playing. And so he wanted to challenge himself. He wanted to grow. Not everybody's up for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just kind of want to lock it in and ride it, which I mean, I'm sure a lot of people do for a long time, like you said, until they get bored.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and there's that, like, how could you not capitalize on, okay, I'm hot right now for this certain thing. Let me cash in mm-hmm. and get the savings account, make the investments, get the retirement account. You know, it's like, especially for industries that are so volatile and where you can just be, and athletes have it 10 times as worse because, you know, you can only play for a set amount of years that your body will allow.
Right.
You gotta like be smart in those years when you're hot. You gotta be smart with your money. And I assume it's very easy. Most people, I probably would. How do I cash in now?
Yeah.
And then maybe later I'll decide to get a little more choosy and a little more specific in what I want now that I feel that I have security for my future, my family, blah, 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 blah. But
sure.
I don't see that in Phil's career. And part of that might just be he's not a typical movie star. You know, mm-hmm. he's not what we would deem, you know, unfortunately, what we would deem as movie star looks, you know, actor type, which is his superpower. I think it's what makes him so great. But he stayed out of that trope.
And Tim, I mean, you speak into this just, you know, given your background with all this too. I mean, is it, you know, I know theater was a big part of his career and life. So, I mean, when you compare those people that make theater a part of their life, they seem to be a different type of actor than, you know, people who are straight just cinema or movies.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the old thing of theater is the actor's medium and film is the director's medium. It's like he tried to stay in the theater and do a play of some sort every single year, because I think there is true freedom and acting artistry in its purest form happens on a stage, because it's uninterrupted, it's continuous, it follows a character arc. You go from the beginning of the story to the end of the story, whereas in a film, you're desperately just trying to get the take. You just need the take that fits into the story, and you're there to help the director and the editor have things to choose from and be able to put it together, and you're shooting out of order, and it's just it's a totally different animal. But when you're brought up in the theater, acting is, you love acting. Like that's the thing that you're attached to, that you've fallen in love with. And sure. Yeah. Of course you bring that with you to any film you do as well. You're grasping for that same feeling that you get in a theater. You're trying to bring it into a film set, even though it is significantly harder. At least I've found.
Agreed.
You got to see the money coming in. It's through the roof, man.
So I want to wrap up here. My last question, going back to sort of the film and the ending of the film, which we alluded to earlier, what do you guys think is happening at the end here? Do you think, like, what is the point of this movie is part of the question. And does God get the last laugh in this, or like, what the hell is going on?
This is a classic 90s movie. Everybody has to leave happy at the end. Right, Matt?
No comment.
There's so many 90s movies. When you say that, you mean like 90s popcorn, Hollywood, cheesy movies.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. In a movie like this, of course.
I'm just generalizing. I'm being an ass. I'm just kidding.
That's okay. We're used to it.
Ooh,
just kidding, Joel. Yeah. I love you.
Now you're an ass.
That's a given too. Hey, but speaking of, I mean, we have not even knocked this around yet.
Yeah.
Boyd, the kid who walks at the end, correct? Looks exactly like Joel. Joel, I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
But the whole time I was like, who is this? This is Joel.
All right, so for everybody out there, Matt's never seen me in his life. I'm just kidding. He has seen me. I don't know how he thinks I look like him.
Joel, you gotta listen to it. You look a little bit alike. A little bit. Joel.
Young Joel.
Middle school Joel.
Like, yes, that's, I don't mean now. I mean, like, I
now
picture...
you're like handsome and old, but you know, young Joel kind of looks like this kid. I have to agree.
Okay, cool. All right. I did not expect that to come up during this hot podcast interview. Like, all right. All right, I look like him. Cool.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, maybe what I'm really getting is like the God factor. All of us have, you know, all of us have experience in church, in religion. This is a part of our lives to varying degrees today. It's been a part of all of our lives for many years. That's part of the reason I asked you guys to come on this episode. What is going on with God and religion in this movie? How does it connect or not connect to each of you? I just love to hear kind of your takes on that. Because I found it, honestly, I'll just say for my own part, I found it difficult to like walk away with some sense of theological opinion on this movie. So I wanted to see if you guys were able to pull anything from it.
Oh man,
positive or negative?
No, I think the whole reason he left at the end was like he came to that realization that everything he was doing, and he knew it all along that it was just a farce. But yeah. when the kid actually walked, you know, he has that whole conversation with him and he says, you know, you got to look out for the true ones, the real ones, and you're that. Yeah. And I think that shook him. And he's like, I can't keep doing this. And then as he's driving off and it starts to rain, then he's like, okay, I see. I was wrong. Like, this is hilarious. And it's like all of a sudden he became, I don't know, it felt like that was like a conversion experience almost for him where he was like, all right, praise Jesus. It's raining, you know. It's not when it's going to rain. It's when's it going to stop, right?
I think it's just so funny to, well, I mean, obviously, yeah, being raised in the conservative Christian vein, it's, you know, I loved the opening scenes where they're pulling off crutches and wheelchairs off the 18-wheelers. I'm like, incredible. Yes.
So good.
This is a part of their whole thing.
Part of the show.
And it's like, all right, so the big question is like, does God win? It's like, yeah, he wins and he loses in this circumstance, I think. I think it's like a win because it's like, okay, cool. Like somebody got healed authentically, we think.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, you know, people have faith. Somebody gets healed. This is the real deal versus the farce that's been the movie the whole time. But then also it's like, God loses. People, not everybody gets healed like that. Like, this isn't real. This is, the whole thing is a farce. I mean, like, the movie's a farce. The healing's a farce. It's like, there's so many people who can't walk, who can't hear, who have financial hardship, and none of that goes away.
Yeah.
And so it's like, but.
So what's the point of the movie then?
Well, I think you were talking about that earlier with no happy end. There's nothing good about the ending of this movie. It's confusing. It's like, all right, so this guy's rubbing this girl's feet and they're married and, you know, kissing butterflies. And then this guy runs off in an 18-wheeler. It's like, I don't know. The kid's left hanging.
Okay. Hey, he ran off in an 18-wheeler to go start the largest revival 2 years later in Pensacola, Florida.
That's right. That's right. Here's my stab at it. Okay. Here's my stab at it.
I've got one too. So go ahead.
My stab at it is that the key scene is after he talks to the kid and Marva, and he's like, yeah, you can come along. And then he tells Marva, hey, tell that kid just because someone leaves you doesn't mean they don't care about you, you know, which is what happened to him when he was young, right? His mom left him somewhere, totally abandoned him. He walks outside and he sees communities forming. He sees people taking care of each other, people feeding each other. It was like this weird, he was trying to, he was trying overtly to do evil. He's trying to exploit people and get their money and then skip out of town. But in his efforts at evil, good actually, and I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying this is what the movie is trying to say. So I don't, here's a stab at what the movie is trying to say. He is doing, he's doing these evil things, but from it comes good. And it's almost like God is slapping him in the face and being like, haha, look, Jonas or Jack Newton, whatever his real name is, you're trying to manipulate and create something totally for yourself, but look what I've created. You know, in spite of that, people are taking care of each other. People are finding meaning and purpose and community. And look, I healed that kid and now it's going to rain. F you, man. I think that's what the movie's trying to do. I don't know that it actually works or is meaningful or really lines up when you look at like all the manipulation and all the like, does that make up for this holy roller, you know, slapping people in the spirit and saying, you're going to get a new job and you're going to be able to hear and your neighbor's fence isn't going to go up. It's like, do the ends justify the means? I think the movie's trying to say yes, but I'm not sure that they do.
I mean, I'm going to, if it helps you, I had written down pretty much the same exact thing, Tim. I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I said, you know, he's standing there in front of the crucifix and he looks at him. He said, why'd you create so many suckers?
Suckers.
And he's like starting to come to this realization that, you know, he's been doing this because it's been easy for him to do. And then he's, I think, trying to create redemption for his own childhood when his mom left him on the corner. Yeah. By doing the same thing to the kid, but then telling his sister, like, hey, he's going to be sitting here, give him this message, okay? Because he's trying to save him from the same life he had by bringing him along. Mm. And then I had the same thing. He's walking through the field, seeing all these different people from different backgrounds, races, taking care of each other, all for the cause. And it moves him, right? And then he's driving in the truck, and the rain comes, and that's kind of like the final straw.
I think he has to leave because I was trying to do something for myself and that is no longer happening. I can't be a part of this because I'm someone who does things for themselves. That's who I am. So I'm going to leave.
Well, I thought for a second, for sure, he was going to ask the 18-wheeler to stop. He was going to get out and go back and say, see what I did? I thought that might happen too.
I'm actually glad he kept going. I thought that was the better choice for the movie.
I agree.
And the girl didn't seem surprised when she walked in and, you know, noticed that he was gone or whatever. It was just like,
which was a little
figured weird. That would happen one day. I guess I'll stay here and get married and rub my feet.
Right. In Kansas.
But you know, one thought that crossed my mind, if we want to tie it real deep into biblical.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Right. Jonah and the whale. Okay, and his name is Jonas. He had to be thrown overboard in order for the storm to stop.
He's like Jonah, but an ass. Jonas.
Right, Jonas. But he had to go away in order for the rain to come. I don't know. There you go. That's.
But it's like the inverse of that.
It is. That's Jonas versus Jonah. Yeah.
That's interesting. Huh.
There you go.
That's pretty good.
I think they did some good by letting Jesus be the guy who healed the kid and not the Reverend. I thought that was a good, you know, salute.
Good PR for God.
Yeah, good PR for God.
Yeah.
It was definitely, you know, all things work themselves out together for good. You know, like that definitely was the feel him walking out of the tent. It definitely gave all those vibes. And so there was, I think, I mean, I would agree with all of you about the overarching arc of that. Mm. But I would just say that my critique is, it doesn't feel whole enough for it to feel real.
Yeah, well, it's like these things are too complex and gray to make a successful 100-minute movie about. Like, unless it's like a totally different style. You know, at least this style, this like weird dramedy romance, whatever this was, like getting into that miraculous territory, it's like you either got to go full Angels in the Outfield where it's just like this fun, like, look, there's angels and they're helping the guys win. And why? It doesn't matter. It's fun.
Right.
You know, it's Christopher Lloyd being hilarious. But you also don't want to go like Martin Scorsese Silence or First Reformed. Oh, I'm saying I want to go there. Those are the more interesting meditations on spirituality and religion. This movie is trying to do something in the middle, which I'm not actually sure it works. You know, it's like Righteous Gemstones works,
right?
Because it goes full comedy.
Hmm.
You know, it fully spits in the face of these things and reveals the evils and the tropes. This is trying, it's trying to blend. And I don't know that that's possible.
Well, and you said, and the time, like the time given to each idea, like you said, it was like 90 minutes of farce and then 10 minutes trying to wrap it up. It's like that. Right. That didn't work.
And weird blips of butterfly kisses after bedtime prayer.
Butterfly kisses after bedtime prayer.
That's going to be our go-out music.
No, what your go-out music needs to be is Neil Diamond's Brother Loves Travel and Salvation Show.
Sounds pretty spot on.
That pretty much is, I think they listened to that song and were like, this would be a great movie for Steve Martin.
Oh my gosh.
And then made
you
it
mean
into
Michael
a movie.
Keaton.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. Steve, after Michael leaves, we'll just get
we'll
Steve.
Throw it to Steve.
Right. Were you there in Pensacola during the revival, Matt, in 92?
Oh, true. That's pretty close to you back then, huh?
Oh my gosh.
I just want to know. You pulled that song out like it was like, you know, in your back pocket. I just want
to
know.
Well, you have to understand there are two people in the world, two kinds of people in the world. There are those who love Neil Diamond and those who don't. Mm. My wife loves Neil Diamond.
Mm.
That's a what about Bob?
Yeah, what about
you? Movie band fans.
Oh my gosh, that's wow! You know, I finally saw that movie, Matt.
Well, good.
I've only seen it once. It was good. Bill Murray was awesome.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's
but great. Amy really is a Neil Diamond fan, so yes, that's how I heard that song.
Mm. Got it.
But no, I was not there. Sorry, I wasn't allowed to go participate in such things.
How far is Pensacola from Gainesville?
I don't know. I've never been there.
Yeah, right. You were there. You led that revival. You were there. You were the Philip Seymour Hoffman of that revival.
Oh,
I can see it now. I've seen that music video of you jumping around your room with headbands. I know what you were doing back in the late 90s.
Why do you think they named the character Matt?
Oh, yeah. Based on a true story.
It's a documentary.
That's how you made your money.
That's right. I got typecast.
Oh, gosh. Well, fellas, this has been a pleasure talking to you all. Before I run these end credits and we close out, anything that you feel like you didn't get off your chest? I know we didn't go too deep into the God stuff. I personally don't think this is the movie to do that because the movie doesn't do that. So why honor it with that type of discussion? But anything else about the Phil performance or the film that you want to throw out there before we wrap up?
I mean, if you're going to bring up Matthew McConaughey from now on, you should definitely mention Beach Bum as one of his finer films too.
Oh, yes. Everyone, I was in Beach Bum. That's why Matt is saying that. I was in Beach Bum very briefly. It was a very brief scene. It was a quick scene.
It was the Philip Seymour Hoffman of Beach Bum scenes.
No, it really wasn't. It wasn't even that.
Should have taken more risk.
Ooh, dirty. Dirty.
No, just true. Hey, I'm just
probably true.
No, it's true.
I'm a fucking idiot.
Thank you for listening to That's That. Please remember to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Spread the word. If you're a Hoffman lover, please, please spread the word. It'll help get the podcast out there to more Philip Seymour Hoffman fans. We'll see you next time with an in-depth look into the 2011, based on a true story, drama, biography, sports movie, Moneyball, starring Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill, Robin Wright, Chris Pratt, and of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman. The logline for the film is as follows. Oakland A's general manager Billy Beane's successful attempt to assemble a baseball team on a lean budget by employing computer-generated analysis to acquire new players. This is an excellent film, actually. It's currently streaming on Netflix, so please check it out. It's been in the top 10 of Netflix since it came on a few weeks ago, actually. So check it out. Join us for a deep dive. My guest will be New York City-based playwright and friend, Stephen Brown. That's That is sponsored by One County Film, an independent film company telling stories with authentic characters and unique settings. You can rent our debut feature film Palace on Amazon right now. We wrapped production and finished editing our second feature film, which is now out there, hoping to get a run at the festival circuit. Also check out our YouTube channel. Our friend Jose, who I just mentioned, is doing Criterion Roundup, where he's watching films on the Criterion channel and giving some opinions and thoughts on whether or not you should watch them as well. So follow us on all those social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all at One County Film. That is produced by me, Timothy Mark Davis. It's edited by Ryan Arnst. Our show music was composed and edited by Jessica Ray Huber, and our graphic was designed by Drew Hannigan. You can connect with me on Twitter at TimothyMarkDAV, TimothyMarkDav, and Instagram at TimothyMarkDavis. Joel, Matt, where can the people find you if you would like to be found? Joel, we'll start with you.
My Instagram is Joel__D'Souza. That's where you can find me.
Beautiful. Matt, do you want to be found?
Sure. My Instagram is at Matt M. Wright. WRIGHT. And that's where you can find me.
Beautiful. Joel, Matt, before we leave, I need the guests to quote Adam Sandler from Punch Drunk Love in a line he says to Dean Trumbull, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the line is, "I'd say that's that, mattress man." Joel, we'll start with you.
"I'd say that, mattress man." Wait. I don't understand what's going on. What are we supposed to do?
You're supposed to say,
"Oh, you just didn't do that."
I don't. That was so confusing.
Oh my gosh!
All you have to say is, "I'd say that's that, mattress man." Go ahead, Matt. Why don't you start?
"I'd say that's that, mattress man."
Joel.
"I'd say that's that, mattress man."
That's that, everybody.